On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
From 4 a.m. next Thursday morning, travellers who have been in any number of a range of countries, including the United States, Canada, France and Italy, will be required to undergo mandatory hotel quarantine for at least 12 days when they arrive. But this, of course, comes after a very long internal debate within government around exactly who should be subject to it and whether there should be exemptions for some countries where they have large Irish populations. Well, we're joined to discuss that and more in studio by the Green Party leader and Minister for Transport, Eamon Ryan. Minister, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Gavin.
And thank you very much for coming in. A lot of people will wonder, not alone about which countries will now be subject to mandatory hotel quarantine, but what is the exit plan? So before we talk about the perhaps the inconsistencies in which countries it applies to, how exactly are we going to get out of this? Now that we're going to require quarantine for people coming from the United States or from France, what is the medium term project to get out of that again?
There'll be a whole range of changes that will allow us to get out. Changes, and I was listening to what you're saying there about kind of, you know, long discussed, you know, in terms of which countries go into this list.
Even that, well, it was because it was 10 days.
Yeah, but even that changed during the week, during the last week, at the last minute, and will continue to change. That's what, one message is that this is not fixed. For example, Israel is coming out now because as their vaccination program seems to be delivering a significant reduction in transmission, the health authorities said, well, we could take that country off.
Just
the
by
list.
The by, why were they added in the first place? Was it because of variants or because of infection rates in general?
Both, very high incidence, and also concerned about variants, as I understand. To give another example, we had expected Germany to be on the list, but it wasn't.
It was on the recommendations 10 days ago, yeah. And it's now been dropped.
And what's the difference between France and Germany? Because Germany, the incidence is reasonably high, but they haven't seen the same level of variant concern. And this is a difficult, this is where the health advice, you do have to rely on health advice because that's an assessment of risk of health issues. And what we expect is that as other countries vaccinate and bring their numbers down, that countries will be taken off. This is not a permanent, this can't be a permanent process. It would also, in my mind, there are also likely further future changes. And this, we are going to have to adapt. As Europe adapts potentially a digital certificate in terms of whether someone is vaccinated, that might be another variation in terms of how this is applied that I
so
would expect.
So be able to prove that you're either fully vaccinated or that you've recently been infected and therefore have the antibodies.
We don't at the moment have that capability. There isn't a national international certification process. But if as that comes in, I would expect that could be a way that it changes.
Does that mean then that any incoming traveller from these countries, because there's pretty high vaccination in the United States, that even if they've been fully vaccinated for the time being, they'll be required to undergo hotel quarantine?
Yes, because we don't have an international certification process. There is still, we'll have to wait for, again, health advice on that. There's still some concern within the health authorities that even post-vaccination people may be transmissible. So they're cautious around that. But I would expect that will be a change that we will see in coming weeks and months.
But is it beyond the wit of man, though, instead of having a formally, you know, standardised international green cert, is it really beyond us to recognise the paper version of the records that the United States issues relative to our own? So that if somebody comes with the thing that was issued by the Californian Health Department, for example, is it really beyond us to recognise that and go, yep, that's a valid one. You got your second shot 2 weeks ago, you're good to go.
I expect we will, but that process is not internationally in place yet, and that does need to be there, and it needs to be reciprocal. Can I say, I also expect, for us here, the approach to the managing risk around the virus is multi-layered. It isn't as if there's one specific measure. Like hotel quarantine is a useful way of adding additional protection, but it's not foolproof. We still have an open border with Northern Ireland. We're not going to be able to close that border. So it's not as if this on its own is going to be the key measure to protect us. We still have domestic transmission. We still have 400 or 500 cases a day. So it's not as if, now there's been about 10 cases, I think, from those 400 or 500 people who've come in to date who have been positive. But actually, we still have significant clusters within our own state. So this is a multi-layered approach. One other layer, and I think one I would put a lot of hope in, is there's a story in the Sunday Business Post today, Simon Harris starting to develop testing in our colleges where we do significant testing of antigen, new antigen tests. And this will be slightly different. Anyone who's had a test to date, it's quite, you know, it goes right to the back of your nasal cavity.
Your
it's
nose.
Not nice.
Yeah.
New ones, Mark Ferguson presented to government the report report that the expert committee we commissioned to look at this, new ones for antigen testing are self-testing, where it's in the lower nasal cavity, so it's relatively easy to do. It's much less expensive. The recommendation, or where we expect that to go, is that people would be able to take a test twice a week on a very regular basis. So,
as has been done now in the UK pretty widely.
They're starting to do it in Luxembourg and a number of different countries, UK included. What the potential benefit that provides, it doesn't give you a foolproof. It's not, as the health authorities have been very concerned about this, because it's not fail-safe.
No, it exchanges accuracy for time, basically.
Yes. And what it does is it picks up if you're transmissible at that moment in time. It won't pick up if you're in the early phases of infection, or it won't pick up the way the PCR does, where you kind of a legacy infection. But if you're transmissible in the moment in time, Mark Ferguson said to us, it's a very high accuracy. And the benefit of that is you can start to really identify clusters as they occur. Okay. So because we don't have a complete sealed border, we're going to need this. Because what we'll need to do then is really rapid response when you do find someone who's transmissible, to contact trace all their people, to really make sure that they isolate. Yes. And that's the critical thing. It's not just about international travel. It's how we continue to isolate when we are at risk or when we are transmitting.
There's one other question about mandatory hotel quarantine I want to come back to. I accept that it's not the only tool in the armory. But when it comes to antigen testing, there have been a great number of scientists and a great number of people around the world that have been looking for this for quite a long time. Why is it taking quite so long for Ireland to fall in line with what is clearly now emerging as best practice elsewhere?
Well, we didn't. I mean, for example, we have introduced it. I mean, we introduced it very quickly earlier this year when the French authorities looked for it to cover for Irish hauliers, because at that time they were concerned about us being a risk of this new B117 variant.
And so the same is true for the Netherlands. But the point is that it's only ever been introduced when prompted by other countries instead of following their lead as a screening tool.
We have also used it as a screening tool here. The health authorities have been very concerned about it because they are nervous that it might be seen as a kind of a guarantee of catching transmission, but that you'll have false negatives, which would mean people would then go on to transmit others. So they historically have been very cautious around it. What I think what Mark Ferguson and his group is saying is that new types, and it's only just evolving now, a new form of antigen testing that is, as I said, that it's easy to self-administer, that is relatively cheap, so you can do it in large volumes, give you the kind of mass screening that we didn't have to date. It was still a relatively slow, cumbersome, expensive, awkward procedure. Mm. What he says is that these new testing procedures, the one that Simon Harris is rolling out now to colleges on a test basis, is much easier. And because of the scale of testing you'll do, that is a game changer. Mm. Now, there's still concern in the health authorities about that. Mm. It was a minority report from Mark Ferguson's team, because there was still concern within some people in the health side that it doesn't give you proper cover. But I believe, particularly when it's applied at a mass level, so when whole swathes of students or workers are tested in that way, I think it will be a very important part of our armoury.
One other point on mandatory hotel quarantine before I move on. There are some countries in the 70-odd now that are added to the state's list, which are subject to these measures, which don't have any variants of concern, where they've been added solely because, and the law allows for this, they've been added solely because of the sheer level of COVID-19 that there is in those jurisdictions. And people have pointed out, you know, maybe somewhat facetiously, but they point out the likes of Bonaire, you know, islands in the Pacific, or they've pointed out Wallis and Futura, which are added to the list because simply of the prevalence of COVID-19. I looked at the ECDC list this morning, and Hungary has the world's fourth highest incidence rate of COVID right now, 1,117 per 100,000. In other words, 1 in 90 people right now in Hungary is infected with COVID-19. Why are they not added to a list when other countries that has far lower incidence rates are in fact added to this list?
That is where the health authorities have to, and I presume what they're looking at is they're looking at the genomic testing within those countries, whether that is giving them an accurate picture as to what level of variants there are.
But there are some countries which have been added not because of variants, just because of the presence of COVID there widespread it is.
I would imagine those countries, it is that they don't have confidence in what the level of screening or otherwise to know what the variant is. To be honest, Gavin, when it comes down to individual assessing countries like that, that is where you do have to rely and health advice. You have to, like, and as I said, in my mind, it's not foolproof. We shouldn't kind of think, oh, there's false confidence from that. We have further layers, like, just to add the other layers, we have the layer that you have to have a PCR test before you come here, anyone. Mm. When you get here, all people have to quarantine at home. New additional measures been put into place now saying after 5 days, you have to take another PCR test. Mm. So it's, the analogy I use is similar to aviation security, where the way they've made aviation so safe is that you have multiple layers of risk protection. So it isn't just whether you're on the mandatory quarantine hotel list. It is the advanced PCR tests, the requirement to take a second PCR test now when you're here, and also the home quarantine. So it's not as if other countries, the risk can be ignored.
But you can understand, though, that the suspicion that some people might have that we're just trying to be the good boys of Europe, that there are some European countries that have really high COVID penetration rates. There are other non-European countries that have lower ones, and we're banning the non-Europeans, but we're letting the European ones go.
I don't think Hungary would be a country where we're kind of, you know, would be where we'd be Hungary versus France, which we'd be trying to butter up one versus the other. I don't think it's on the basis of health advice.
Okay. I want to talk to you about other issues. And you launched your landmark climate legislation a couple of weeks ago, overshadowed by other issues, which we'll get to as well. You were quoted the other day as saying that some of the provisions of the climate legislation and the need to cut back on emissions would mean the end of 10 euro flights to popular holiday destinations like Malaga, for example. What will be the end of that? Will it be that you're going to tax, aviation fuel, or what's going to bring about the end of cheap flights like that?
Just to put in context, I was asked a question on another radio show. In 2030, would there still be 10 euro flights, cheap flights for everywhere? And I had to answer honestly that I don't expect there will.
And why not? Will oil just be that much more expensive, or what's going to drive that?
That'll be one factor in it. And again, the answer I gave, which is true, is as I see it at a European level, I'm on the European Transport Council of Transport Ministers, and what we're starting to see there is initiatives from the European Union level to say, if we're going to tackle climate change seriously, this idea that, you know, flight for $5.99 or $9.99 or whatever, that is not something that's going to be, in 10 years' time, something that would be part of a low-carbon future.
Yeah.
So it's likely, in my mind, in that sort of time frame, there's nothing immediate on the the table, but certainly I hear other ministers and the European Council discussions starting to consider one of the measures looking at. It's not the most
significant. A tax on aviation fuel? Because it seems quite anachronistic right now that there aren't really any carbon taxes on aviation fuel.
There's no regulation or no restrictions on aviation, unlike all our other domestic travel. And yes, I expect that aviation will be included in the likes of the emissions trading scheme, which does start to put a cost. And that's another reason why it's unlikely that we'll have the low fares, that kind of, you know, bargain, what they call last leader type aviation fares, because aviation will start, not just in Europe, but internationally, as the climate, in the UN process, the idea that aviation is the only sector that has no tax on fuel, no restrictions on cross-border trade in carbon in that way, that's not likely to be the case in 10 years' time.
There's always, though, the argument against carbon taxes of any sort, whether it's on aviation fuel or whether it's on just diesel or petrol that people use to power their own vehicles, that it's going to add to the cost of living everywhere else. You know, we're an island state or an island nation. We're heavily reliant on international connectivity. If all of our international shipping either comes through air or sea, and you make all of that more expensive, it's going to make everything in life much more expensive. Is that something you can stand over?
That's what was very significant this week, I think, in terms of the stories this week. The really big story was Moneypoint working with Equinor, a Scandinavian company, with an expert in the world leader in offshore floating, to say we're going to tap into that power supply. And potentially to convert that, what we have, a huge abundant renewable supply, which can be very competitive, low cost, and then to convert it into the likes of hydrogen, which in talking, I had a meeting with various hydrogen interests, people were promoting this new strategic direction during the week. And what they were saying, in the likes of shipping and aviation, and again, this is 10 years away, this is not an immediate prospect, but it's very likely that we will see those sort of fuels becoming substitute fuels for oil and gas. And
not for airplanes, though.
Potentially, yes. That in every sector, we're going to go to net zero within 3 decades. This is committed to. This is what the US administration, Chinese, European administration is committing to. And we have to. The science says that's what we have to do.
So and electric planes or hydrogen powered planes?
Potentially, yes. Our alternative substitute fuels won't be easy, but with the level of investment and the level of regulatory kind of pressure that's going to come from US, European, Chinese, Japanese, every other government, I believe that technology with change will come. And the only way it'll come, or the way it'll come quickest and best, is when it's a better economy. We will not do this just by a hardship posting on people and saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, it's going to cost you this, it's going to cost you that. What we have to do is do system change where the alternatives are better, cheaper, cleaner, more secure. And for Ireland, that's a real potential because we have huge renewable resources. If we can convert that power then into other fuel supplies, the likes of hydrogen, that gives us real security.
In the meantime, before you develop alternative fuel sources for international aviation, there are nearly 150,000 people who work in that sector or in aviation-linked jobs in Ireland, and they don't feel like there is any master plan to make sure that their roles are secure so that when the pandemic is past us, when there's mass vaccination, when there's digital certs, they're not entirely confident the industry will still have survived to allow people travel again.
I meet them on a regular basis. And yes, those industries are critical and important. We need connectivity in our country. We need to be able to travel and fly. We will not serve those industries well, though. If we went out with false promise to say, oh, well, listen, we can open up now and everything's fine, we're still at a very high risk phase. We still have a critical 2 to 3 months ahead of us when we vaccinate. What the industry, they want more than just as much as everyone else is what they don't want is for us to go back into another lockdown. Mm. So this is not the time. Yes, we will have already done a huge amount of supports for those industries, as in every other industry. Aviation, tourism, hospitality, the arts are the worst hit. They will require the most support as we come out of this. Mm. But if I was to come out today and say, oh, we've got we have a plan now, we're going to open this way, when in truth, our focus is razor sharp on the immediate next 2 to 3 months to avoid. We don't want to give false expectation. We can't give set dates yet because we need to see how it progresses in the next 2 to 3 months. And that's the right thing to do.
How did you feel when you first heard that HL2 had gathered enough signatures to contest the Shannon election?
Oh, well, listen, I was very aware of it because I've been talking to Hazel about it over several weeks. So it wasn't something that was kind of a bolt from the blue. And we had different views. Like my view is, well, people know my view is, but people are entitled to have an alternative view. And and our own parliamentary party and executive yesterday have addressed it.
She's entitled to have her view, but is she entitled to go what was against, although not a binding mandate, the stated wish of the parliamentary party and by the national executive, which was not to contest the election?
Well, we met with the executive yesterday and we agreed we're going to review our processes because we do need to. And we need to learn from this and also the previous Shannon election in terms of how we do our process. But that's not, I mean, we had a unanimous decision as executive to do that yesterday. I think that's appropriate. It takes about 3 months. But what my focus is absolutely, come back to what I said there on how we managed the COVID crisis, but it's also how we deliver on our programme for government. The Shannon elections are important. Our democratic system is central.
Maybe they're not germane to the running of government, but a lot of this is prompted by the fact that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael put together an electoral pact and didn't consider of putting you inside it, so that they decided they would back each other's candidates for these two various seats and you guys were left out in the cold.
No, they asked for our support, but they recognised we have our own processes and have to consider that. Historically, in previous...
So they went to you and asked for support for the pact and then you, in a fractured party, weren't able to deliver it?
I think pact is the wrong word. They asked for support for the candidate. There's not really a pact in that. But historically, we have within government supported government candidates. I think government, you need strong government. You need to be able to deliver on your programme for government. Having additional members in the Shannon or in the Dáil which support the delivery of the programme of government helps us as well as them. So that was the argument I made.
Do you have dibs on the next vacancy?
No, I think there, as I said, it wasn't a pact in that regard. But that is historically what typically did happen is people, you know, you vote for people in government and return, they also vote for you.
But you don't have an assurance that the next time there's a vacancy that the Greens will be allowed to choose who from the government gets to fill the seat?
No, because we didn't have a pact in that way, as I said. It was, but I've recommended to the parliamentary party that we do what we've done, which is support government candidates and in that way give us strength to deliver on the programme of government, which is the real focus.
Are you happy with Hazel Chew continuing as chairperson of the party?
Yes, and as I said, we had a good meeting with our executive yesterday. We've a healthy tradition in our party of allowing difference and where we have difficulties, we resolve them by setting up a process, which we set up yesterday to review what is the best thing to do.
Eamon Ryan, Minister for Transport and Communications and leader of the Green Party, thank you very much for joining us in studio.